Hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you by our listener-supported community radio station, WEFT, broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois at 90.1 FM and webcasting live worldwide at WEFT.org. Views and opinions expressed here are those of speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of director, or Perrier Incorporated. And stay tuned here. We're going to then listen to a few underwriting announcements. We'll be right back.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. at Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon, Urbana. For more information, visit www.centralillinoisjobswithjustice.org. Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. The World Labor Hour is supported in part by listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. The Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio. The Campus Faculty Association at the University of Illinois advocates for academic freedom, shared governance, and a strong faculty voice on campus. CFA is proud to support Community Radio and the Labor Hour in support of strong unions. You can learn more about the CFA by visiting cfaillinois.org.
Okay, we're back. You're listening to the World Labor on the supported community radio station, WFT in Champaign, Illinois. And I'm proud to announce that Gus Wood is back live in the studio. Welcome back, Gus.
Yes, I'm back to cause some trouble in Urbana-Champaign.
Yes, good trouble that is.
I'm gonna be back and forth though, and kind of like this Batman Bruce Wayne thing. You know? I gotta keep doing this research so I can finish this dissertation. But there's so many great things happening here that I was called in early to get involved. So I'm so happy to be back to for the listeners.
Okay, we also have a special live guest here in the studio that we're gonna introduce here in just a moment. We're gonna kind of divide up news stories today a little bit. We're gonna do a few here in the very beginning, and we'll pick up on some of the rest of them later in the show. And also, we're gonna be having a discussion about what is neoliberalism later on. So, Gus, should you start out?
Well, you know, it's become apparent to the working people in this country that there is a very big push by the neoliberal and corporate media to push out this idea that America is actually great. You know, they're trying to go against this Donald Trump phenomenon of America is not great, we need to make it great again. So they're pushing out a lot of really bad information that's hurting people, especially the lived experiences of the working class. The Obama administration, the Democratic Party, and their allies in the corporate control media have hailed the Census Bureau report that came out this past Tuesday, showing that claiming that the U.S. economy has turned the corner, because what happened in the report is that it gave you numbers that 5.2% increase in median household income is the highest year-on-year increase in a half a century. Plus an increase in the number of full-time year-round workers by 2.4 million, a drop in the poverty rate from 14.8% to 13.5%, and a drop of 3.5 million in the total number of people living in poverty. The number of people without health insurance also declined significantly. And this is what the Obama administration and the corporate media is calling a successful time for America, because we're out of this recession all of a sudden. But again, these triumphant conclusions drawn by the Obama administration and these ridiculous media people, they fly in the face of the actual experiences of the working people. A careful examination of the figures, and people know me, they know I love my data, in the current population survey, the CPS, the formal name of the study, this data suggests that the stuff that Obama and they're saying is complete is not only premature, but it's actually not accurate to the actual numbers. Because again, there are three things that we have to understand. First, the numbers are always skewed. Number two, there's always a select group of people who are no longer looking for work anymore. And number three, wages have continued to stagnate and not match the rising cost of living. The 5.2% increase in household income from 2014 to 2015, which is celebrated in the media, was the first annual increase in median household income since 2007, before the Wall Street crash. However, median household income remained 1.6% below the 2007 figure and 2.4% below an all-time high reached in 1999. How is it possible for the median household income to rise by 5.2% overall when the figure for workers holding full-time year-round jobs is so much lower? Only if the minority of workers who were not employed full-time and year-round saw a much larger increase in median household income. Many workers who were limited to part-time work in 2014 or were unemployed entirely went back to work or worked longer hours in 2015. This does not mean they got a raise. A minimum wage worker who went from 15 hours a work week in 2014 to 30 hours a work week in 2015 would see a doubling in his or her income, a 100% increase entirely from longer hours, even as their pay remained low. In other words, median household income may rise significantly through an increase in working hours rather than an increase in hourly pay. Given that real wages have remained stagnant or risen only slightly, that appears to be what has happened in 2015, and these numbers are complete superficial. Low-paid workers worked more hours, and most new jobs taken by previously unemployed workers were in the low-paying sectors, like healthcare, restaurants and bars, nursing homes, retail outlets, etc. So again, when we get this data, we cannot allow the Obama administration, the federal government, or any corporate media to celebrate. We need to get these numbers, and we need to get in their face and break this crap apart, because they're wrong.
Yeah.
The living conditions of working people are still bad because the cost of living is skyrocketing, wages are stagnating, And the only people who are actually benefiting from this so-called increase in median income are the people who were already wealthy.
Yes. Yes, indeed. And we'll get more into that as far as when we talk about neoliberalism, yes. You know, because there's some good data on that too, yes. Both historic and more recent. Okay, a couple of quick news stories here. I guess there was a Solidarity Forever Union victory as faculty bust the Long Island University lockout. This victory shows what happens when labor can come together, when different unions work together. This was decisive. Dr. Ralph Engelman has talked about the Long Island University faculty forcing the university to rescind its lockout of its instructors. And anyway, we've got another story here about after a two-month delay in allowing the union access to the South Bend, Indiana facility, the union says Honeywell Incorporated frustrated the UAW union's efforts by not living up to its legal obligation to allow comprehensive negotiations. And lastly here, I got about Colin Kaepernick's protests getting lost in the national anthem backlash. Basically it says, I have a simple question regarding Colin Kaepernick and his decision to take a knee during the national anthem. What is he protesting again? Well, in case you've forgotten, it's police brutality. It's police brutality against people of color, a major issue in cities all over America. Exactly. You know, so we got to make that. Okay, real quick here, as far as the lockout, you know, they were saying that, you know, this was, man, this was, you know, they got locked out for almost, it was about 2 weeks, almost 2 weeks, and, this was unprecedented, you know, to where university instructors, were locked out, you know, and it's just, unbelievable.
You never really hear that much about lockouts happening in education unions or education labor. You always hear about lockouts in more industrial labor, you know, things like that. So this, like you said, this was very unprecedented. And what it did was it actually opened it up for other, education locals and unions across the country to recognize that, wow, this is the type of administration that we work for and that we're facing. Not only do we have to support the locked out workers, but we have to understand this in the context of what's happening in our situations as well. So this was a very big event for the education labor in this country.
Indeed. Okay, I'm gonna right now I'm gonna do some public service announcements here, and then we're gonna get into our special in-studio guest here. Let everybody know that WebFest is gonna be starting today outside in front of WFT Studio, 113 North Market Street. All of Market Street's blocked off, and this is basically celebrating WFT's 35 years on the air, and that's gonna be from 2 to 7 today. And there's gonna be a lot of good bands: Rainbow Flag, Jose Gabo, Brazilian Workshop, and Anger Management, and the Painkillers. Oh, those some good bands.
I know, right?
Okay. And anyway, this is, again, celebrating WFT's 35 years of broadcasting, listener-supported corporate-free radio. And again, we're still on pledge drive, so if you could call in and make a pledge as whatever you can afford, at $40 level, you can actually have your own radio program and vote for the board of directors. Any amount's appreciated. You can call 359-9338 to make a pledge, or you can go on the website at WFT.org. Let you know the CU Immigration Forum is going to be having its third annual Immigrant Welcome Award ceremony, and that's going to be at the Urbana Free Library Saturday, September 24th from 1 to 4:30. And let you know that next week at the 12 o'clock hour, we're going to be having Ephod Hawk on here, who yes. All of us here in the studio know from various struggles and organizations. He's part of, I didn't know until I saw him at the farmer's market, he's also part of the CU Immigration Forum. Yep. He's going to be here talking about wage theft, nationals as well as local, and that they're going to be having a forum on that here, I guess, coming up and everything. So also let you know that today, this Saturday and every Saturday from 2 to 3 p.m. is none other sports show with host fellow worker Neil Parthen, and that's on WRFU 104.5 FM, as well as at WRFU.org. And also this Sunday and every Sunday from 4 to 5 p.m. is Labor's Worldview TV. And to let you know that there's going to be a community support rally for the teachers, the Champaign Teachers Union, that's in some pretty obstinate negotiations right now.
Yep.
And that community support rally this Tuesday is going to be at the Champaign School Mellon Administration Building, which is at 703 South New Street in Champaign. It's the corner of John Street and New Street. And we'd like everybody in the community to show up sometime between 3:45 and 4 p.m. If you have to come a little late, that's fine, but the teachers are going to be marching from Central High School to the Mellon Building, and we want to have a community welcome there for them. And we're going to be filming this to be rebroadcast on Urbana Public Television. So that's this Tuesday, at 4 p.m. at the Mellon Administration Building, the corner of John Street and New Street in Champaign. And just to get a couple quick quick plug in here for a new movie that just got released in the studios. It's playing at both Savoy 16 and the Carmike Theater here in Champaign. Snowden, the Oliver Stone film. Yeah. So
I've heard good things about what Oliver Stone gets out there. Mm-hmm. Of course, the backlash from the conservatives is that it's a puff piece for Snowden. So that means that he's got some good data in there.
Exactly. That's well put, Gus. Absolutely. And so now I'd like to introduce our special guest here in the studio, Mohammed Youssef. He's studying philosophy, political science, and gender and women's studies here at the University of Illinois. He's from the northwest Chicago suburbs. He's been involved with Students for Justice in Palestine for the past 4 years. Two of which is its president, and he's involved with the Illinois Model United Nations team, and basically his academic work is heavily influenced by an experience growing up in post-9/11 United States, as well as his sister's activist and academic work. Anyway, he's here for the Students for Justice in Palestine, a student group on campus. So welcome to the World Labor Hour, Mohammed.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
You know, I just got to say one thing, too, man. You know, one of the groups that was first out there doing a lot when I came to this university was Students for Justice in Palestine. And that really was one of the most exciting things for me, to see the type of work that they were doing. And they were really some of my biggest allies and other groups' allies in anything that you need done to stopping oppression on campus. And they're actually wanting to ask those bigger questions about how does capital affect what's happening to oppressed groups around the country and on the university campus. So what Mohammed is doing and what his organization is doing is really some of the greatest stuff happening in this area that people need to know about.
Okay, and Mohammed, we got a caller calling in at 11:30. Could you tell us a little bit about him, and then we'll go into all about you?
Yeah, for sure. So the caller is going to be Ben Lorber, who works with Jewish Voice for Peace. He's the National Campus Coordinator, I believe.
Okay.
So he's worked with SJPs all over the country, and I've met him multiple times. He's a great guy. And the focus of Jewish Voice for Peace is obviously providing a Jewish sort of presence in the pro-Palestine and anti-Zionist movement around the world, but specifically within the United States. And they've been a big ally to us. We have a local chapter of JVP.
Okay.
And we've worked with them a lot in the past, and it's really great to have them as allies and, you know, as really accountable sort of comrades in the fight.
Okay.
Especially with accusations of anti-Semitism or something.
Absolutely.
Like that.
You know, and it really angers me when I've heard people that are, like, involved, where they're concerned about the issue of, you know, Palestinian people being called by Zionists self-hating Jews. I mean, that just makes me so angry when I hear that. I mean, you know, that'd be like saying that if you opposed the Nazi regime, that you were self-hating Germans. I mean, if you were a German, you know, and saying you were anti-fascist, you know.
Which is what the ruling class in Germany did to the people that opposed the Nazis at that time. So
mm-hmm.
That's the same tactics.
Yes, indeed. So
I'm a self-hating, you know, just generally white American person.
Well, we might get in that later, but, you know, first of all, anyway. So Mohammed, let's, start with you. Let's talk about before, your guest calls in here in about, 8 minutes. Tell us a little about yourself and, you know, what you've been doing other than this, just, you know, kind of little introduction I gave.
Yeah, for sure. So I guess as of right now, just personally, thinking about, like, graduate school, has been a big deal. And I'm especially looking into places where I can continue sort of my activist work, because I think it's not only central to sort of who I am and my political activity, but it's also very central to, like, the academic work that I'm doing. And I think it's really important, and I think, you know, obviously Gus would agree here, that we have to get rid of, like, the removed academic and think about how, you know, the work that we're doing, if you're in STEM or if you're in the humanities or, you know, the arts, think about how that has political and social and economic impacts.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really sort of where I am right now, personally, outside of sort of the sphere of the U of I.
Okay, all right. And what got you interested in the issue of you know, the Palestinian peoples and you know, the you know, kind of conflicts going on in the Middle East in general?
Yeah. So for me, I think this is a story that a lot of Muslim Americans, or, you know, if you're not Muslim, if you're even Arab, sort of get acquainted to, is that you grow up with the issue sort of in your mind. In that, you know, you're always told, like, oh, this is one issue that you should be paying attention to. And that was sort of, you know, basically my introduction to it. My sisters were both involved with SJPs on their campuses when they did their undergraduates. My father's also been very active in sort of just keeping up to date with, you know, the issue in Israel and Palestine. So when I came to campus as a freshman, I knew I wanted to get involved in some way, shape, or form. And I found myself being drawn to all sorts of issues of social justice, whether or not it's you know, SJP or, you know, trying to get into the Black Lives Matter, sort of chapter and sort of the student movement surrounding that on campus, or issues of like gender, rights, labor, like worker rights. And I saw that SJP would be sort of like a good fit for me, to not only work on that issue, which I thought at the time wasn't getting enough attention, mm-hmm. and still, in my opinion, isn't. But it also acts as a way for me to work with all these other causes and all these other groups that I truly do care about.
This is a trend I've been, a very encouraging trend I've been seeing over the last several years, about, various different organizations that could very easily just focus on the concerns of their groups, you know, instead they see the bigger picture and they see how this all, you know, interconnects, with, you know, other, groups of people that are fighting for their rights and everything, and how they realize it's all part of the same struggle, more or less, a common enemy, if you will.
I think that's something that we're harking back to the 1970s with, you know, that this idea that, you know, it's that we are an oppressed group. We are a colonized people, but we're also a class of people who are subject to the same capitalism, the same oppression, et cetera. And then we recognize that. And then, you know, it's this way of, you know, making sure that all different groups of identities are represented within that class,
yeah.
you know. So it's kind of like, you know, the students on campus, particularly the organizations, we're trying to actually bring out that idea.
Yeah.
That there is a unifying factor behind our oppression, and it is our class and also all of our identities within that same class.
Yeah, otherwise, if it's just focused on the, you know, it becomes identity politics, which of course, as we know, the neoliberals are great at exploiting, playing one group off against the other. And this I guess a term for this is intersectionality, I guess. That's the term I just learned
exactly.
About. Basically, you know, just, about 3-4 months ago, frankly. And, you know, I saw a diagram of it, you know, basically these big loops of different groups all kind of intersecting, you know. But one thing I didn't understand, I said, okay, this makes sense if, and I drew a circle in the middle of it and I wrote class, you know. Mm-hmm. I said, this makes sense to me now. You know, otherwise it's just a smorgasbord of identity politics. But when you have the class base to it, you know, that's when it makes sense.
And I think that's what I really love about what Muhammad does. Like, we have these panels and forum discussions, you know, he, you know, when I participated in one in the spring, and he said, you know, make sure you talk about this idea of, you know, exploitation and class, you know. And I think that's important, that one of the things we have to get out is the difference and also how it affects us between exploitation and discrimination.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's something, like you said, the university and the neoliberals, which we'll talk about later on,
mm-hmm.
they know how to, for lack of a better term, exploit that the not, and I say this word for not knowing, that the public has the ignorance of not understanding the difference of the two,
mm-hmm.
and how that's how they can allow capitalism to continue to evolve. So,
indeed.
Yeah.
You know, one thing I've noticed over the last, probably decade, is that, you know, all these liberal groups and stuff that like to come out and, you know, support different causes. Boy, I tell you, it's almost like they treat the Palestinian rights issues almost like the plague. I mean, have you had that experience?
Oh yeah, for sure. Something that, you know, we sort of call in sort of activist circles as PEP, Progressive Except Palestine. you could label that as Bernie Sanders, or really any sort of these other groups, which, you know, pretend to be progressive. They'll come out and say, you know, we believe in Black Lives Matter. We believe that, you know, wealth should be, you know, redistributed so that everyone is, you know, has better access and, sort of just rights in general. But when it comes to Palestine, they'll sort of shrug away and be afraid to really confront the issue. And I think there's, you know, multiple different factors that go into that. One of which is sort of just the influence of the Zionist lobby on, American foreign policy and American political thought. And I think another sort of major role in it is, you know, the fear that is instilled when we conflate anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism.
Indeed. In fact, let's listeners know, being a Zionist aren't just Israelis, aren't just Jewish people. There's also fundamentalist Christians that are Zionists, and, you know, other people out there that aren't Jewish that are Zionists.
Yeah.
And I really like the fact that you work with Jewish Voices for Peace.
And Jewish Zionists might think that consider that these people have their own agenda. These groups that you're talking about, for example, the Christians, they think it's going to bring the second coming.
Yeah.
They don't care about, they want all the Israelis to die in the second coming.
Yeah. Yeah.
You see, they don't care about Israel.
Yeah. And I read a book about a year and a half ago, what's his name? It's called, Goliath, Fear and Loathing, mm-hmm. in Israel. Mm-hmm. And I can't think of his name right
now. Max Blumenthal?
Yes. Thank you very much. Oh my God. That is a great book. I mean, man, I mean, the thing is there is resistance within, in Israel amongst Israelis, but boy, they sure have a difficult time of it. I mean, first of all, they refuse military service, they might as well forget about ever getting employed. You know, and yeah. that I was really, it was in, and there's been a lot of Israelis that have went and stood with Palestinians being, you know, attacked by, you know, the Israeli defense forces and that sort of thing. And they get attacked by right-wing mobs at times. In fact, one of the, you know, slogans that they chant a lot of times at some of these right-wing rallies is death to Arabs, death to leftists.
You know,
and that there's a huge, immigration from Israel every year, going to, you know, the United States, but also Germany is one of the big places where so many young people are leaving Israel because they just can't take the situation. It's just so horrible.
And something else to consider, I think, is, and a lot of people forget this, if you want to learn more, David Sheen is an Israeli journalist, and he covers this a lot, is the treatment of Ethiopian Jews in Israel.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there have been cases, like, the prison situation in Israel reflects the U.S. greatly, where, you know, Ethiopian Jews and black Jews in general make up a very small proportion of their overall population, but make up a huge percentage of their prison population. And, you know, they've been subject to forced sterilization. They've been subject to, you know, basically, you know, like, basically all services become inaccessible to them. It's very much like mirroring the treatment of black Americans, except in Israel. And I think a lot of people sort of gloss over that to view it as like an Arab-Israeli sort of issue. But there's so many more dimensions to this. And I'm really glad you brought up the leftist part, or, the death of the leftist chant. Because anti-Zionism in Israel is, within the Jewish community at least, it's bigger. It's more popular than it is within the Jewish community in America.
Oh, wow. How ironic.
But the issue is, like, because you have parties like Likud and, you know, leaders like Benjamin Netanyahu in power in Israel, the suppression that leftists go through is so much greater. So if you're talking about, you know, justice for Palestinians or justice for Ethiopian Jews, or even issues like housing, like affordable housing in Israel, is a massive issue, and it just gets glossed over because of this created and contrived existential crisis that Israel is supposedly going through every day through these small sort of aggressions.
Mm-hmm. Essentially. And just to make it clear, too, I think the listeners, you can, you know, tell me if I'm right or wrong on this, is that, you know, Gaza is like the largest open-air prison in the world. They've got no army. They've got no navy. Fishermen can't go more than, I think, 5 miles off of the coast to fish. They don't allow anything to come in unless it goes through the Israeli army's hands. And, I mean, you know, to say that they're a threat to Israel, I mean, give me a break. I mean, that's like saying a gnat is a threat to an elephant. I mean...
So groups like Oxfam and various UN bodies have published studies that after the 2014 attack on Gaza, the land, like literally Gaza as an open-air prison, will be unlivable within 5 years.
Wow.
Just because there's like the water, there's no water supply, power's continuously going out, and there's just the infrastructure is completely destroyed. Mm-hmm. Because in the 2014 attacks, Israel, as always, uses methods of collective punishment. So if they had one suspect in an entire apartment building, they would just bomb the whole building.
Wow.
And you can find like evidence and videos of this online, and it's making the entire area just completely unlivable and unsustainable.
Okay, we're gonna take a quick music break, and we're gonna be right back. You're listening to WFT, the Supported Community Radio Station. This is the World Labor Hour, and stay tuned.
Life is worth, you would look for yours unheard. your eyes. Get up, stand up,
get up, stand up.
Don't give up the fight.
Life is your right.
Get up, stand up.
We can't give up the fight.
Stand up for your right.
Lord, Lord.
Get up, stand up.
Keep us bubbling on.
Don't give up the fight.
Yeah.
Hello, WFT, you're on the air.
I'm Jewish.
Okay, yes, welcome to the program. Are you speaking on a cell phone?
Yes, I am. Is that all right?
Yes, but I can barely hear you. I don't know if there's something you can do to increase your volume.
Is this any better?
Yes, it is. Okay, so could you introduce yourself to the listeners again, please?
Yes. My name is Ben Lorber. I work as campus coordinator with Jewish Voice for Peace, and so I work with college students all over the country who are organizing for Palestinian rights.
Okay. Well, we have a local member of your organization here in the studio, Mohammed Youssef, so he's going to be part of sort of the interview today. So basically, I guess I'll let Mohammed start off with some of the questions for you today.
Definitely. Hey, Ben.
Hello.
So I guess something that I've been thinking about lately, and I'm sure you have too, is sort of the events that are unfolding at UC Berkeley with regards to the student-led course being canceled. I believe it was called Palestine, A Settler Colonial Analysis. So if you'd be willing, could you expand on that possibly and sort of just give your thoughts on what's happening down there?
Yeah, I mean, and by the way, let me know if my voice fades out again and I'll fix it. But yeah. Mm-hmm. This is sadly nothing new for college campuses, as I'm sure Mohammed, from your work at University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana, where Stephen Salida was fired. All over the country, there's a network of very well-funded right-wing pro-Israel groups who are basically pressuring university administrators to do things like cancel courses sympathetic, quote unquote, sympathetic to the Palestinian narrative, fire professors, ban course content. And I mean, and it's McCarthyism, and it's an assault on academic freedom. And, there's looking at a syllabus of the course that was supposed to be taught at Berkeley, they accuse the course of bias, really, but there's nothing about it that seems biased. If anything, it seems to be giving an even account of the Palestinian narrative, a narrative which is often overlooked in our media and our society. And so we're all sort of waiting. The students are still trying through various means to see if the course can be reinstated. My organization released a petition, and we'll see what happens. But this is basically the modern McCarthyism, and it stops.
Yeah, it's truly a travesty, sort of in respect to both academic freedom, but also sort of just the method of putting Palestine out there as an academic sort of subject and not just one of activism. And you mentioned something that I wanted to expand on, and that is sort of funding by these conservative Zionist organizations. So I don't think a lot of listeners, and I think people in general, especially on campuses, are aware of just how well-funded a lot of these groups are, and the backing that groups like Hillel, or here at the U of I, we have Illini PAC, which is an APAC-affiliated organization. And they receive a lot of funding from groups like Stand With Us, and they've coordinated with groups like Canary Mission. So I was wondering, because I know Jewish Voice for Peace does a lot of work to counter these conservative Zionist sort of groups and these forces, especially on campuses. So could you expand a little bit on sort of what Canary Mission is? Because I know there's been a huge campaign to try and shut that website down and really expose it for what it is, and that is, harassment. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about Canary Mission and the conservative sort of Zionist forces that are present on campuses across the nation.
Yeah, sure. Well, I encourage, people to go online and look at Jewish Voice for Peace made a report about this recently, as well as the organization Palestine Legal made a report talking about this network of right-wing pro-Israel organizations. I mean, you know, like, we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars being spent to try to derail BDS on campuses. I think it was the summer before this previous summer, Sheldon Adelson, who's a billionaire who operates, you know, casinos, who is the number one donor to the Republican mm-hmm. Party, and who single-handedly bankrolls one of the most right-wing newspapers in Israel. He's raised, you know, he's committed tens of millions of dollars to fight BDS. The Jewish National Fund committed over $100 million alone last year, and there's literally dozens of organizations who send, you know, paid Israel advocates on the campuses to work closely with students. They often embed what's called an Israel fellow directly inside Hillel, which is, you know, an institution for Jewish life that, you know, should not, you know, take a stand on political issues mm-hmm. halfway around the world, but should just be a space for Jewish students to express their culture and their religion. And, you know, but essentially, I mean, you know, these organizations work very closely with people on the ground, and they work very closely with not only, you know, those in power in universities, like the administrators, but also with politicians across the country. So you'll get situations like, you know, at many schools, as a divestment resolution is being debated, the local state representative will, you know, write letters directly to university student government members. I mean, it's absurd that, you know, that the, you know, the state representatives who have a lot, you know, who have a lot of important things to care about running their state are under so much pressure that they feel compelled to bully, people in student government at a university about, you know, passing a resolution about a political conflict. It approaches absurdity. And, like, as you're saying, like, one of the most egregious and upsetting forms it takes is through a website called Canary Mission. And essentially what it is it's basically a blacklist that contains the names and the photos of students, mostly across the country. It's predominantly the Palestinian Arab and Muslim students and mm-hmm. other students of color, and it links to their social media accounts, to their Twitter, to their Facebook, to their LinkedIn profiles. It it attempts to portray them as anti-Semitic, mainly by, you know, scouring the internet for whatever quotes they can find attributed to these students that say things like, you know, basic facts about the conflict, such as, you know, like, Israeli settlers are, you know, like, stealing, like, the Palestinian land. The mission will claim that's anti-Semitic, and essentially it's a way to frighten and to bully these students, many of whom are, you know, trying to get their first job after college, or are international students on a visa, or, you know, or are Palestinian students, and it makes them afraid that their name on the internet is going to be forever, tarnished by false accusations of anti-Semitism.
Yeah, and so, something that we had been talking about before you called in was sort of solidarity and this concept of intersectionality. And I think it's really poignant because when we're bringing up, you know, sort of blacklisted groups, I know last year SJP faced a lot of harassment and sort of backlash from Zionist groups on campus. But when we banded together, all that sort of stopped. And it was kind of funny because when we started working with groups like Black Students Revolution, at the U of I, or groups like Mecha, which is a Chicana student organization, the GEO, the Graduate Employees Organization, CUTES, the Campus Union for Trans Equality and Support, when we sort of band together, a lot of this, you know, harassment stopped. And I thought that it was entertaining because that's the problem with sort of this liberal ideology is that, you know, it's really easy to attack one group for their sort of identity or their political situation. But when you have, you know, a group of people banding together and understanding the interconnections between these groups, you know, at that point to fight back and to sort of harass everyone would be untenable. And I think something that really highlights this is when the Movement for Black Lives endorsed, Palestinian Liberation and BDS in their platform. The leader of J Street came out with an article essentially saying like, oh, black liberation is conditional on the, you know, on you supporting Israel as well. And literally that's an indefensible claim.
An absurd claim.
Even the people I know here in J Street who consider themselves liberal Zionists, just didn't know what to say. They were speechless just because of the pure ridiculousness of that statement and of that idea. So I think going along with what Ben was saying, in that when we have, you know, groups like Canary Mission or groups like Hillel, you know, your run-of-the-mill AIPAC affiliated groups attacking students, one remedy to that is not only learning more, and I highly suggest reading up on stuff that JVP has because they have a lot of good articles and studies on it, but also banding together. And I think that's something that we've been having more of on this campus and as an activist, but you know, it makes me really excited. As a senior who's leaving soon, it makes me kind of sad that now we're sort of at the peak of activism on this campus, because truly I don't think it's been this great since possibly the 60s, you know, during that student movement. And I think that we're galvanizing a new one. And like David, you were saying earlier, like this sort of common enemy idea where you have, you know, the liberals and, you know, the conservatives, quote unquote, sort of, they become indistinguishable at a point. Mm-hmm. And that point is really when you start using intersectionality as not only sort of this theoretical basis, but through practice and understanding that what ties these groups together in sort of their hatred and their harassment is this idea of capitalism and colonialism and how they...
And racism. They all tie, they're all part of it. Martin Luther King even said this, you know, militarism, capitalism, what was the other one, Gus? Militarism, capitalism, racism, of course. Yeah. I forgot the obvious.
Imperialism?
Yeah. But, you know what? This is really insidious. I mean, how this AIPAC group actually, you know, targets, individual, you know, students and academics and puts their photos up. I mean, like, almost like it's a hit list for a death squad, you know? Yeah. That's frightening. Really frightening.
They equate groups like Students for Justice in Palestine, and even the Muslim Student Association, which, you know, at least on this campus is incredibly and abhorrently apolitical, with groups like the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas. Ben Shapiro, a conservative Zionist sort of mouthpiece, came out and said that SJP is Hamas on campus. And I think that, you know, at a certain point, I think, you know, Ben, feel free to chime in. At what point does sort of the fear-mongering surrounding pro-Palestinian activism engender, in a sense, like anti-Semitism? When you get to the indistinction of anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism, and I think we saw that with Stephen Salida as well, where criticism of Israel is automatically considered anti-Semitic.
Mm-hmm. And they equate basically anti-Zionism with anti-Jewish or anti-Israeli sentiments, which, you know, I have a friend of mine that lives in Oakland, California that wrote a good book about the history of Zionism. I mean, it's a little pamphlet, actually. In fact, he's Jewish. His father lived to be 103, died about 6-7 years ago, who had to leave Germany real quick in 1933 because he was the editor of a local Red Flag newspaper and, you know, moved to the United States. So, I mean, it's really interesting because the main gist of his pamphlet, I should say, is that Zionism is a political racist organization. Basically, it's an ethnocentric group that basically they didn't resist the Nazis. In fact, they collaborated with the Nazis in a lot of cases. So, you know, Zionism does not we're not even getting to, you know, post World War II and, you know, the beginning of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, you know, the invasion basically of settlers, if you will.
Annexation.
And, you know, I talked to a Jewish man who died about 10 years ago, in his, he's almost 90, and he left, his parents sent him away from Germany in 1933 when he was 17 to Palestine. And he said that, you know, the years he lived in Palestine from 33 until, I guess roughly about 1950, he said the Jewish, people that lived there in Palestine at that time and the Arabs got along fine. I mean, maybe occasional personal difference or something, but there was no problems until the Zionist movement started to invade Israel after World War II. That's when the real problems began. And he left Israel, moved to the United States. He couldn't take it anymore. You know, so Jews Muslims, you know, Palestinian Muslims, there's a, you know, precedent for this that they can live together in peace, you know?
We were talking about this before the show, the same thing, and Muhammad brought this up earlier in the show about how there's a mirror with the U.S. and what happens there. Same thing with working class black people and white people before Bacon's Rebellion.
Yes.
you know, the exact same thing, that their people were living fine until this very repressive idea of race came along.
Pushed by the ruling class, yeah. Divide and conquer.
The ruling class, divide the working classes who were ready to topple capitalism over. But again, so the exact same things happen, that there's a culture created that undergirds a lot of this is happening. It creates these animosities between these two groups from living together and toppling what is their common enemy.
Yes. Okay. I'm sorry. So go ahead. We just had to throw that in there.
Yeah.
The sort of tie, I think it ties in real well here. I mean, you know, because this is going to be the attack. You know, anyone who criticizes Israel is anti-Semitic, you know?
As, you know, Jewish Voice of Peace, as a Jewish organization here, we're really firm, you know, that criticism of Israel's policies, criticism of Zionism is not anti-Semitism. Unfortunately, like, you know, when what happens is the opposition will, you know, will cry wolf around anti-Semitism so much that everyone starts talking about anti-Semitism, you know, all the time. And what happens is that, like, Palestinian voices, Palestinian narratives get erased and get silenced. So it's always important, you know, which is really the shame, you know, also about this course, you know, at Berkeley, is that, you know, it was going to be, you know, taught by a Palestinian student, and it was, you know, basically, you know, an attempt to, you know, like, to present the Palestinian narrative in an even-handed way for discussion and for, you know, for academia. And, like, so we need, you know, on campuses, you know, Palestinian students are often, you know, very vocal at the forefront of their Students for Justice Palestine groups, and, you know, they're leading the student movement, which I agree with what Mahana was saying, you know, all across the country is pretty much as exciting as the student movement in the 1960s, and it's gonna keep getting stronger. The pro-Israel forces in this country are afraid, which is why they're pouring hundreds of millions to fight it. But in the coming years, you know, we're just going to see it keep growing stronger. And yeah, it's a new era for student activism, as well as for, you know, racial justice and intersectional activism all over the country in tons of ways. So even though there's a lot to be, you know, afraid of in some ways, there's actually not much to be afraid of. And it's a very exciting, time to live in.
That's a great point. And we've unfortunately come to the end of our interview time. Could you let the listeners know some information sources that they could so they could find out some more information?
Yeah, I'd encourage you to go to JewishVoiceForPeace.org and also, you know, to check out the work that Students for Justice in Palestine is doing at U of I Champaign-Urbana and, you know, at hundreds of schools all around the country. They're leading the way.
Okay, well, thank you so much for calling in today.
Yeah, thank you all so much for having me.
You bet.
Keep up the struggle.
Okay, take care. Okay, Muhammad, I know you have to leave fairly soon, so let's just kind of end here, I guess, with whatever you kind of want to wrap things up, you know, how people can get, you know, either involved or find out more information. And by the way, I love this story about banding together. I wasn't aware of this. This is really inspiring.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if people want to learn more, we're all over social media. We have a Facebook page, SJPUIUC. We're on Twitter. We're going to be launching a website, hopefully, before the end of the semester, if not next semester, where people can learn more about just Palestine in general.
Mm-hmm.
If you'd like, we have an emailing list. You can contact us through Facebook or email, which is sjp.uiuc@gmail.com, to be added. And there we're going to be really focusing on our events and the events of our sort of groups and that we work with. So, you know, all of our events are open to the public. Our meetings, however, are, you know, for the core members on campus. I also just want to give a real big shout out, to the Black Students Revolution and, because, us, you know, SJP worked with that group, and around 25 other groups, to put together a set of demands. And you can see those at bsfruiuc.com. And the demands aren't actually necessarily to the administration of the university. They're more so demands for a transformed sort of campus.
Okay.
And they're aimed at the students. And they cover everything from, like, worker rights to, you know, parental leave, gender, you know, like, fair access for all gendered students, as well as, you know, campaigns for, like, BDS, which is the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement Against Israel, fossil fuel and coal divestment, private prison divestment, and, you know, obviously tuition, sort of elimination over the next in the coming years, as a way to make higher education more accessible, but also they're sort of reflective of the changes that we need in our society as a whole. It's not necessarily a campus thing. It's not necessarily a student thing. You know, us as students, we start here because this is our main sort of not only social circle, but also where we inhabit and where we live. But, you know, those changes will eventually be reflected within society, we believe.
Okay.
So if you want to support student activism, definitely check out SJP, definitely check out Black Students Revolution, and all the other groups that we work with. The entire list can be found on the website.
Do you have any events coming up in the near future here?
Yeah. So hopefully in the first or second week of October, we'll be having a Palestine 101 event with some professors and former students from around U of I. And with that, we hope to just, you know, spread general information about the conflict and about what we do, the role of student activists, talking about like allyship and appropriation, and how we can build a sustainable and accessible student movement that can eventually be spread, you know, just, you know, outside of the campus grounds into the community. And, you know, we'll be releasing information on that shortly. You know, community members are also welcome to attend, because something that we really want to try and push for is working with the community more, because we come and we'll work with groups, you know, in sort of small stages, but really, you know, especially with something that I sort of got involved with over the summer was opposing the sales tax increase to fund the new jail.
Yeah.
And I was only minimally involved in that. I'm minimally involved with like the local IWOC as well. And I think that, you know, strengthening those ties with the community makes our movement much more sustainable, and it's much more comprehensive, because, you know, we need to be, you know, everyone needs to be sort of pro-justice and pro-liberation. It can't just be students.
Yes.
And, you know, there's sort of a disconnect there, and I think that all campus organizations need to try and bridge that gap.
Okay.
I think the demands do that as well.
Yeah, the demands do a great job of doing that.
The demands are very much so about not only bridging the gap, but destroying the gap altogether, to where the campus and the community become as one, especially in terms of getting labor to the community and dealing with the unemployment issues and the low wage work that are being given to particularly the African Americans in the North End. You know, the university has to stop outsourcing jobs and start hiring directly from the community as well.
Indeed.
And that's something that is very much so doable by the demand timeline. So,
yeah. And just for a historical note, you know, being 59 years old, I lived in this town all my life. When I was in grade school, middle school, when the Vietnam War and the, you know, African-American uprisings were occurring, it was here in Champaign-Urbana, too. And I know that, you know, especially with the anti-Vietnam War protests that got pretty, you know, pretty intense. They called in the National Guard, I think, four times. And, you know, they had dusk to dawn curfews. But what's interesting is it started with the students, but hordes of young people in the community flocked over on campus and joined the numbers, you know, and swelled their numbers, you know. So I mean, this to me is it's happened, and it's doable for the future. Yep. You know,
I just heard Michael Parenti on another radio show.
Yeah,
and in fact, I think it was on Back in the USSR. That's on a Canadian station.
Yes,
and he was talking about getting beaten by the police and how basically what happened during those demonstrations kind of drove him from academia.
Huh.
More or less, in a lot of ways. Cause, I can't remember the exact story now. In fact, we ought to try and get Michael Parenti, man. I think he's got a new book out, and he's a great interview.
Okay, well, we're fastly approaching the 12 o'clock hour. Muhammad, thank you so much for coming in and being a co-host for the day with a caller. And I love this Palestine 101. That's a great name for it.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks for the opportunity. Thanks for having me, and I hope we'll see you there.
Absolutely. Yeah, okay. Right. Thanks again. Okay, you're listening to World Labor on the Supported Community Radio Station, WFT in Champaign, Illinois. We're going to take a quick music break, and we'll be right back.
Until the philosophy which old one race superior and another inferior is finally and permanently discredited and abandoned. Everywhere is war. It's a war that until they're no longer first class and second class citizens of any nation. Until the color of a man's skin is of no more significance than the color of his eyes. Mr. War, that until the basic human rights are equally guaranteed to all without regard to race. This a war. That until that day, the dream of lasting peace, world citizenship, rule of international morality, will remain in but a fleeting illusion to be pursued, but never attained. Now everywhere is war. War. And until the ignoble and unhappy regime that hold our brothers in Angola, in Mozambique, South Africa, subhuman bondage, have been toppled, totally destroyed. Well, everywhere is war. It's a war. War in the east. War in the west. War up north. War down south. War, war. Rumors of a war. And until that day, the African continent will not know peace. We Africans will fight, we find it necessary, and we know we shall win, as we are confident in the victory of good over evil.